All right, we can get started. Achron, Achron, Chaviv. Okay, we'll, Chut HaMeshulash Lo B'Mehera Yina take. Okay, Bakasha.
So I'm just trying to pull up my source sheet here. Everything is happening more slowly today. I'm sorry, I have to pick up this file. So, in the meantime, so I guess last time we started talking about Moshe Rabbeinu, and we started talking about the signs that were given to Moshe Rabbeinu at the Sneh. And today we're going to keep going down that path, but we're going to take a somewhat different tack with it, because now we're not going to be talking about the signs given to Moshe in order to think about the idea of, let's say, nivu'ah, or communication with the creator of the world, and how that might be related to those signs, and that might be a commentary we can look for in those otot, in those signs. But in addition, we're going to be thinking about specifically how it might be interesting that these otot have to do with a discussion about the boundary between life and non-life when viewed in material terms. And, you know, I am like a broken record saying Shivim Panim HaTorah. There are lots of different ways that you can pull meaning out of the same psukim and Torah, out of the same verses. And we don't try to settle on one of those meanings as being the one that finally matters or means something. The truth of the text is certainly in that it may contain these facets in this interlocking fashion. However, I do want to focus specifically on one way of reading these signs given to Moshe. And I think, just to give a little background and context for that discussion, I think that sometimes we have a tendency to think a little bit naively that there are certain sorts of questions that are so fundamental to the beginning of the universe, or the beginning of life, or the beginning of our conception of what a human being is, that if we don't find them in the first prakim, the first chapters of Sefer Bereshit, of the book of Genesis, then that should have been where we would have found them. And if they're not there, and if they're not floating close to the surface, then it must just be something the text chose not to treat. You know, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu had other things in mind with what he wanted to put in the Torah. And I do think that it is fair to say that if things are not there right at the beginning, that there is maybe a kind of a priority or a focus that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has in shaping the Torah, and it's initially pointed at other things, or it wants to talk about them in a different way. But I do think that sometimes we can find things that really are treating some of these fundamental concepts elsewhere in Torah or in Tanakh, but especially even in the first five books in Chumash, in somewhat unexpected places, if we just kind of wait for the text to take up the subject. And I think there's good reason to approach it with that attitude, because, as I think maybe I said in the first Shi'ur, when we do see the Torah taking up a subject, I don't think it just does so in order to prove to us that it's smart or something like that. It's only going to do that because it has a purpose in educating its reader as an Oved Hashem, as a servant of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which means that it's not enough just to show the reader that there's some kind of appreciation of a way of looking at the world or understanding something. There also has to be some kind of understanding that the reason the text is talking about that subject is so that it can make a point to you about how you should view your actions or behave differently in the world, or how you should understand the mission of someone who's trying to keep the Torah. And I think that's something I'll try to put together today. And so we're going to be trying to talk about what seem like very fundamental and weighty subjects, things like the question of how the tradition treats the idea of the material body and what we sometimes talk about as the immaterial soul, although I think perhaps in some cases there are kind of concepts that end up getting imported from other ideologies that Judaism got heavy exposure to in the last 1500 years, let's say. And if you go to the original sources, I think maybe you can kind of talk about it in slightly different terms. But I think the beginning point of this discussion is in a strange place. It's in this passage where Moshe Rabbeinu is being first called to go to Bnei Israel in Mitzrayim and liberate them from Avdut, from slavery, and to go to Paro and bring the name of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the name of Hashem, to Paro and tell him that, you know, there is no greater power. So how do we kick this off? So the first source that we want to look at here, source one, is one we talked about last time. It's the first of three otot, the first of three signs that Hashem gives to Moshe when Moshe says, basically, how will these people believe me? You know, what you're saying to me, so let's say I believe you, that you are who you say you are. You're the God of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. You're the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, who is calling upon me to go as a liberator and take this people out of Mitzrayim. But why would they believe me? What can I show them that will convince them? And then these three otot, these three signs, are given to Moshe. And the first one is, take a rod or a staff, a mateh, that Moshe is holding. So it's a vayomer elav Adonai mazeh biyadecha vayomer mateh. Vayomer ashlicheo arza, vayashlicheo arza vayhi lehash vayanos Moshe mepanav. So Hashem said to him, what is that in your hand? And he replied, a rod. He said, cast it on the ground. And he cast it on the ground, and it became a snake. And Moshe recoiled from it. So that's the first oath. The second oath is that Moshe's skin becomes mitzorat kashaleg. He becomes a mitzora, meaning, so this is now a very specific, a Torah-specific piece of terminology. A mitzora is a kind of person who has a sort of a definition in Jewish law as defined by the Torah as having a problem with their skin that changes their status as far as tumah and tara, like impurity and purity, and their rituals and rules associated with where they can be and how they can become pure if they start off as being mitzora and impure, etc. And so here the skin is described as, or at least his hand, which presumably the skin on his hand, is described as being mitzorat kashaleg. So that's the second sign. And it's a little more complicated. He puts it to his breast and then it becomes mitzorah, and he moves it back and forth, and it sort of toggles the tzorat. And lastly, there is, I'll skip over source three and go back. There's this sign in source four, that you take the water of the Nile, you pour it on the ground, and it will become dam bayabeshet, right? So it's not just water, but it's the water specifically of Hayaor, which is the Nile River. So you should pour it on the ground or on the dry ground. Yavesh is dry, so it's focusing on the dryness of the earth, the lack of water. It'll become blood on the dry ground. So those are the three signs. And again, lots of different ways that you can run with this. They're incredibly rich, densely packed real estate in terms of concepts. The thing that we should focus on today is all of these otot, all of these signs, are in one way or another treating the subject of crossing the boundary between life and non-life. And maybe I would even go so far as to say, focusing on the kind of physical or material aspect of that transition. So if you look at the first ot, the first sign, you have a stick. The stick is dead. It's a rod. It's an inanimate object. It's in Moshe's hand, as we discussed last time. And then he throws it on the ground, and it becomes a nachash, which is a living animal. And he's presumably recoiling from it, perhaps, because it's sort of writhing around like a snake. And so it's not a dead snake. It's becoming a live snake that, you know, is kind of scary. And so there is this transition from inanimate object in the hand to the sort of animated living creature. And that's a clear transition from life to non-life, notwithstanding the fact that rods made of sticks are, you know, formerly alive. But in any case, we're talking about sort of going backwards. We're going from something that's now lifeless to something that is living or full of life. The second sign is a little less obvious, but you can either build it out of the narrative or halachic background to tzara'at, or you can just kind of think about it in much more naive terms. So first of all, Moshe is a person. He's living, right? He's a living being. And what is the boundary of Moshe? The actual physical boundary of Moshe that separates him from his non-living surroundings, from the air around him, or some, you know, rock that he's touching. It's his skin, right? The skin is the physical boundary of the living thing. Tzara'at is kind of a disruption or an anomaly in the boundary of the living thing. It's about changing of colors and sort of like shifting landscape of how things look. So it's an instability and an irregularity in a boundary between a living thing and its non-living surroundings. So again, it's about the boundary between life and non-life, and perhaps the ambiguity of that boundary, and even the evocation of the idea of snow is interesting here, because when you look at snowflakes, which are visible in some cases by eye, they have very ambiguous boundaries. They're very branched in an interesting way. The last sign is maybe the clearest, right? If you pour water on the dry ground, you don't get blood, you get mud. But there is something about this oath that's evoking the idea of mixing two things that you think of as being not alive, which is dry, dead earth and water from the river. You mix them together and somehow they become something that is the essence of life. It is the most basic thing that you think of as sort of suffusing the living whole, and that is blood. So all three of these otot, all three of these signs are in one way or another playing with the idea of a quite, you know, material notion of what it would be to undergo some kind of transition from being non-living to being living. And I'll say, as a background and as an aside, that in my professional, let's say, standing as a physicist, or in my explorations and research, in my capacity is the word I'm looking for, as a physicist, this is a topic that I'm quite interested in. And it's probably why I noticed these things. And I will tell you some more things that I noticed in due course. But it's a subject you can research from the standpoint of science. You can think about questions like, you know, if I have a bunch of marbles, so to speak, if I have a bunch of inanimate little hunks of matter that are clearly not alive, but they, you know, stick together and sometimes they kind of vibrate in different ways when you knock them and you can push on them in different ways. What is going to be the set of physical conditions where that collective, that group of inanimate, uninteresting little clumps of, let's say, grains of sand or marbles or things you think of as being, you know, utterly non-living, what's going to get them as a group to start behaving in a way where the whole starts to take on kind of the more complex behaviors of what you think of as being distinctive of life? Things like harvesting energy from your surroundings that's difficult to access, or things like acting in a way that accurately predicts a likely event in your future based on what you learned from what is likely in your past, or things like making copies of yourself. You know, there are certain behaviors that are more distinctive of living things than others. And it may not be that any one of those behaviors uniquely picks out life, but you can certainly make a list that you very quickly say, well, rocks don't do that and fish do, or tables don't do that, but dogs do, et cetera. And you start to be able to say, all right, these are the distinctive behaviors of life. So purely as a scientific question, you can study the physics of how inanimate materials, based on the way that energy is flowing through them, might start to recapitulate what we think of as being distinctively lifelike behaviors. That's something that I've worked on over the years in the course of my research as a theoretical biophysicist. But we're not really here to talk specifically about the biophysics today, other than to kind of give credit where it's due to the text for having, I think, quite a profound intuition about recognizing some of the same kinds of relationships. But I will say, I wrote a whole book about this, which is both about the physics and teaching about that, and also contains Divrei Torah, kind of like what I'm going to talk about today. And the title is Every Life is on Fire. And I'll mention it at the end of this talk. But if people are curious to explore that more. There's a way of doing that. But for this discussion, our point is going to be to try to pull things out of the text that we, as I said before, that really ultimately pertain to the mission of an Oved Hashem, which is not a question about physics. It's a question about why is Sefer Shemot trying to teach us this? Why would it take up this subject at all? What's the point? Because it's kind of an interesting philosophical question. Like, what is the difference between a living thing and the inanimate parts out of which it's made? And you can start to muse about it and just one feels curious about it. But at first it seems like, well, maybe we should just be focused on other things, right? Maybe we should focus on tachlis. Like, what should we do? You know, how do we get the right things for Korban Pesach or Kiddush or what have you? Why would we want to muse about this subject? But I think it turns out to be quite an important thing to muse about, even specifically in the context of the narrative here, right? That Moshe is going to be sent to Paro, and he is going to be tasked with liberating a nation from slavery. And this discussion is not as unrelated to that mission as it might first seem, because if you think about the living being as afar min adama, right, dust of the earth, that's what the Torah actually in Sefer Bereshit, right at the beginning, talking about forming Adam, that, you know, we have a source further down, I believe, which I'll jump to. So source 9, Vayitzer Adonai Elohim et ha'adam afar min ha'adama, vayipach be'apav nishmat ha'im, vayhi ha'adam le'nefesh haya. So the Lord God formed a man from the dust of the earth, and he blew into his nostrils the breath of life. The man became a living being. We'll talk more about that in due course, but the point there is just, afar min ha'adama, the idea is that dust of the earth is not alive. It's just the inanimate material, and it's something is different once you put it together and you make it into a living thing. But if a physicist, or I would argue just a very intuitive materialist, kind of looks at the world, what they say is, well, look, I may seem special, but if I sort of take off a little piece of myself, like a hair or a fingernail or a little bit of skin that falls off, these things are the dust of the earth. They very quickly become just ground into inanimate powder that means nothing, that has no purpose, that has no value. And there is a temptation of a certain intellectual kind, and also a certain ideological kind for someone who has use of this way of thinking, to say, so maybe people are not anything other than just kind of fancy collections of inanimate materials. Maybe we shouldn't really see individual people as having any kind of separate special status. You know, there are various ways you can clump matter together. You can make tables, you can make bricks, you can make people, but we're all just clumps of the dust of the earth that are put together in different ways. And there isn't anything so special about animals or about people other than just they maybe jump around a little bit more, right? Why would someone make that argument? Well, one reason they might want to make that argument is if they have reason to want to be able to treat people like they are particles of dust, which is exactly how Paro would have wanted to treat people when it was convenient for him. There's a midrash actually talking about Migdal Bavel, the Tower of Babel, which is this other, you know, great construction project in an ancient pagan despotic empire, that says that when they're building the tower, that they would weep when a brick fell off the tower, but they wouldn't weep when a person fell off the tower, right? And I think that's kind of capturing the essence of the idea that when you make no distinction between people and bricks, when you're just saying it's all material to be shaped in different ways, then you are maybe more flexible in how you can design your efforts to build really tall buildings, which is what the Egyptians wanted to do and what the Sumerians wanted to do. But you'll do that by paying a price in human blood. And to have an ideology that makes paying that price feel acceptable, you're going to be looking for ways of talking about humanity and about the world that try to erase distinctions between what's alive and what's not, or what is human and what isn't. And then you can just say, well, I'm great and Egypt is great. And we're made great by some of the things that we do with bricks over here and some of the things that we do with people that we grind into dust over here, and it all is just a great system. So I think that's part of the thing that we're kind of looking at in the background here, is that Moshe is presumably, if this subject is coming up, it's because part of what we're looking for is kind of an education in what HaKadosh Baruch Hu's rejoinder is to that nihilistic, anti-humanistic argument. That if we assume that Paro is sort of the Nietzsche of his age, so to speak, and is trying to push the idea of God and being made in the image of God from view, and that Paro is doing that with a goal in mind of using people as though they are implements, then presumably HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to kind of arm Moshe with a counter argument to that and teach him something about how to understand instead what can be distinctive and meaningful and separate and different about certain collections of dust, so to speak, the living, the human collections of dust, and what actually gives them a kind of a meaning and a significance that is not granted to their separate constituent parts or other assemblages of those constituent parts that are not necessarily in possession of nishmat chaim, you know, the breath of life. So that's our goal, where we're going to look for that in this text and try to kind of tease it out by thinking a little bit about what the signs understand and the different directions in which they point. I think the first thing I just want to lay down as a sort of strengthening the case that the text is really taking up this subject is just to talk a little bit about what each sign is getting at and make comments that I want to just say they reflect a profound ability for the Torah to, from the perspective of the human, the untechnical human being, the human being who's not thinking in terms of modern physics, how do you consider the sort of material or physical question of what life is? And there's really some quite interestingly accurate observations that get made, because the signs that are being chosen here are not sort of random and are not inapt from the standpoint of how even a physicist would try to understand the same subject. And I think one of the things that it's important to point out here is that just that it might be the case that physics of the present day is this very rarefied and fancy and special language with lots of mathematics and stuff that people didn't necessarily have as a language or talk about a long time ago, like in the time of Moshe Rabbeinu. But I do think that there's a great deal about what's true about the physical or material way of thinking about the boundary between life and non-life that is accessible to just the intuition of a technically unsophisticated human observer. So you don't need equations in order to capture the essence of many of these ideas. It's just that the equations kind of help you to build up the case systematically. So what are some of the things that I mean by that? Well, one thing I think that's important is, you know, in the first sign, the idea of holism versus reductionism, which is, again, not a question restricted to physics, but it's certainly pertinent to this discussion. Because the staff and the serpent, kind of like we were saying last time, are really like two different kinds of ways of talking about the same thing. So you can look at the world and you can say, let me think about things like everything is its own separate inanimate piece, and it's very regular and predictable. I can make measurements like I can make with a rod. So that's sort of the physical description. I can focus on all the separate pieces as though they have kind of a metrical regularity to them, and they don't do things by themselves. They get acted on and made to do things by hands that grab the staff and make it point or something like that. But then at the same time, I also sometimes want to come and address the system as a whole, right? That the serpent is a whole system. It's a whole collection of parts that are all kind of working together. And it's foolhardy to think of each separate scale on the serpent in its own right and not recognize that they're part of one thing that is accomplishing something that has to be talked about at the level of the whole system. So I think that's one aspect that's immediately jumping out from the first ot that's given to Moshe. And I think the point is that that way of thinking is really relevant, even if you're just going to think about this as a scientist. If you want to think as a scientist does about this question, you will say, all right, what's the difference between physics and biology? Physics is very reductive and metrical. You're going to make little measurements about inanimate pieces, and you're going to break things into parts and think of them as just each moving because of forces that are acting on them and being sort of dumb and inanimate themselves. But when you do biology, you're still doing science, but you have to address yourself to the whole. It has a different teleology, right? You're interested in things like what makes this organism live or die or successfully reproduce or not successfully reproduce or be sick or be healthy. And those are qualitative judgments. Biology today is getting more and more quantitative because we can measure a lot more things about biology, but it's not a fundamentally quantitative science in the way that physics is. And it's not fundamentally reductive. You really care at the end of the day about the holistic phenomenon in biology. And you're trying to kind of build that back up by doing different kinds, giving the living system different kinds of pokes and understanding what the pokes do to it. Excuse me. So that's the first point that I think we want to bring into this discussion. Going down to the second sign, the tzara'at. So we'll return to this when asking kind of about what the meaning of all of this is, like the message that we said, the counter argument that maybe HaKadosh Baruch Hu is trying to give to Moshe. But for now, I think the point also can just be made to think about the challenge of defining the boundary between a living thing and its non-living surroundings. Because a priori, in a physical description, that distinction is absent, right? As a physicist, if I come to a collection of particles and I say, oh, they're all just kind of moving around and bumping into each other, I don't automatically recognize the distinction between the living thing and its surroundings because it's all just atoms, so to speak. And now it's easy for me to express that in the language of modern physics, but I also think that that's still very accessible to intuition, to recognize that there is a whole world and we have to make choices about how to recognize where the boundaries are between parts, different parts of the world. And there are different ways of slicing up the world, so to speak, with different ways of classifying and talking about it. There's a great quotation actually from the very Judaic in his thinking philosopher, Ludwig Wittgenstein, which is the borders of my language are the borders of my world. And that's kind of a 20th century philosophical way of getting at what I think is actually a very deeply and anciently Judaic idea, which is that the language that you develop for talking about something will, in a sense, be part of the completion of its creation. And you can essentially create the system differently by talking about it differently, because your choice of how to talk about it will make different decisions about where to draw boundaries between different things. Like, is an animal a part of the forest, or is the forest, you know, the trees and the animal just is a separate entity that can sort of pass in and out of the forest, right? There are different ways of describing systems, and whether they kind of include their parts or whether they're separated from them and where we draw the boundaries, that can be a choice in language. And I think that's a thing that's being captured here by bringing up tzara'at, because tzara'at is, again, all about this kind of the anomaly in the boundary of the living thing. Like, where does this begin and where does it end? And once we recognize the challenge of defining that boundary, then we realize that we're sort of in the driver's seat. Like, we have the choice to make about how to approach a phenomenon in the world and say, here's where I draw this line, and I say, and it isn't always actually, you know, a line in space, so to speak, but it's here's how I perform an act of categorization. There's a wonderful passage in Rav Soloveitchik's Halachic Ban talking about how one approaches a pool of water and decides whether it's suitable for a mikveh. And I think the Rav really understood very intuitively and deeply how that is related in some sense to how a scientist has to develop a theory of like a physical theory of a system. That's an aside, but So I think the point here is that the tzaraat is bringing in the notion that really we have to choose when experiencing the phenomena of the world, how to talk about them. And we, by making different choices about how we talk about them, are going to actually, you know, participate in the classification of the phenomena of the world and the setting of the boundaries. And that pertains also to a living thing, meaning that we have to admit at the outset the difference between what's alive and what's not, that you could make that kind of blurry if you wanted. You could make that ambiguous. And that's okay. And it might still be the case that we can, at the end, conclude living things have some kind of separate status and that they matter in a way that non-living things don't, even though we encounter at the outset a whole cloth of the phenomena of the world that contains ambiguity and that needs us to make a classificatory choice that partly, for example, might actually have to be done in the world of halakha, which is what we'll get to in due course, halakha being Jewish law. So that's the second sign. The last sign, I think, is the one that most deeply evokes something that to me is remarkably cogent when you look at it from the perspective of how a physicist encounters living things and thinks about them physically. Because everything about, excuse me, what is interesting about living things from the standpoint of physics has to do with the kind of system that living things are. Living things are not just a crystal. They're not just a liquid. They're not just something that's sort of sitting at some temperature and having a very kind of regular and stable and what's called an equilibrium behavior. They're called non-equilibrium systems because they have matter and energy flowing into them in one form and leaving them in another form. And everything about their structure and the complexity of the way they behave and move and the way that they are shaped is connected with this process of flow of energy and matter. The fact that there's something flowing through this kind of conduit, and the way that it flows both shapes the system and also kind of sustains it and repairs it and enables the kinds of distinctive behaviors that we see that really have to be powered by the flow of energy. So when we now look at this ot, this sign that's given to Moshe of taking the water and mixing it with the dirt on the ground, and then it's supposed to become blood, I think there are a few different things that leap out to me as a physicist who thinks about this, which I can share. One of which is, first of all, that qualitative novelty can come just from putting together the same components in different ways, right? So mud is actually a great example of something where even if you just change how much water you mix with how much dirt, or you change how you mix them together and sort of what process, the process by which you introduce one to the other, you can get a lot of different kinds of things. You can make bricks out of mud that you sort of mix together that isn't so wet, and you shape it into a certain form, and then you fire it, and then you get something that's very hard and shaped a particular way. You can get something that behaves like a liquid, but it's just kind of like a very thick liquid. You can get something that you can sort of pick up in shapes, but then they sort of like start to melt and fall apart in your hands. And it all just has to do with like putting the same things together in different ways. And so one thing that I think is clearly being recognized there is the notion that there's great potential in the novelty of combination, right? That just putting together the same pieces in different ways can accomplish completely different things. And it's not, the magic is not in some special essence that has to be introduced in one case, but is totally absent in the other. It's about context. It's about the way the different pieces are together, the ratios of which they are present, how they're arranged with each other, and the process by which they're introduced.
Jeremy?
Yes, yes.
The sound got very static. I don't know what happened there for a moment, and it doesn't look like anybody's unmuted. So,
okay, are we okay now though? Can you hear me?
Now that's better. Yes, it was just for a few seconds. I don't know what happened there, but okay. Thank you.
Sorry. So I'll just repeat. I was saying that there's different ways you can introduce these materials together, and they'll come up with different behaviors. So we have the potential for novelty of combination. And at the same time, also, I think it's quite remarkable that this ot, this sign, is not just about water. You know, get some water, doesn't matter from where, and mix it with the dirt from the dry ground. It's about a river. And what is a river? A river isn't just water. It's flowing water. It's water that is both about the transport of matter from one place to another. So matter is flowing in from one direction and flowing out in another direction. And also, it's about energy. It's about motion, right? All energy is just motion, or the potential for motion. And when you have a river, it's not just that it's water, it's that it's moving water. So you're mixing moving water with the dry earth. And what's remarkable about that is that it becomes, now we're told it becomes blood. And you know, when you look at your actual body, you see these branched veins that are carrying blood through your body. And if you actually can cause water to flow through dirt and earth and sediment, and very easily produce these very highly complex looking branch structures that are not exactly the same things as the veins you see in your body, but it evokes that similarity as an image, which I think the text is capturing very well. The idea is that the fact that the water is flowing can shock you with the sudden complexity of a whole structure that can form, where the different parts have kind of a relationship to each other, because the flow of matter and energy through Earth gives you kind of enough of the physics that life is based on to give you that much complexity. Now, I'm not saying river deltas are as complex as living things, but they are sort of a talisman for that kind of complexity. And it's just a remarkably striking image that the text can bring to bear here by bringing in the idea of river, water, and earth, and then saying, okay, so there's a sense in which the same way that blood suffuses the living whole and connects it and gives you a whole thing that can't just be reduced to the sum of its parts, but is kind of a form and a structure where the whole thing is related to everything else in it. And that's what blood, you know, is in a living thing. It's the liquid that connects every part of the living thing to every other part of the living thing, and evokes the whole, that you get that whole sense, that holism as well, from the idea of water flowing through sediment. And you can actually observe this I think I saw a few years ago exactly this phenomenon just in the parking lot of a Beit Knesset in Newton, Massachusetts, because there was a rain storm or something, and some water had flowed down a hill and washed some dirt sort of down a slope, and you just see, there also are satellite views you can see, or aerial views from very high up, where whole systems of river flow, such as, for example, the Nile Delta, have this incredible branch structure to them that is kind of fractal, and where every piece is related to every other piece in a geometric pattern. So those are, in a sense, asides, because I think they're not 100% necessary in order for us to take from the text what we're trying to ultimately get from it today. But I think what's important is that it brings us this idea that there's a lot actually about the intuition of a human being encountering a living thing, realizing it's this kind of quintessence of dust. It's this collection of inanimate parts at some level, and sensing that there's something about how those parts are collected together that even thinking in terms of different kinds of phenomena in the physical world, that we can make distinction. Like, so yes, it might be true that river deltas are not the same thing as living things, but they're more like living things in certain ways than just a rock that's sitting on a table. And that what that suggests to us is that we should be careful to recognize the possibility that there is something about what we think of as being distinctive about life, and perhaps distinctive about human life, that is really very much rooted in the specialness of the kind of material phenomenon that it is. That because I think what we're going to turn into now is this question of, you know, the material nature of life versus what we sometimes talk about as the soul. What I'm going to argue for is that I think both the Torah and really lots of other things in our tradition as well, they lean against the idea that there's this very easy notion of the living thing as the sort of simple, uncomplicated and worthless material vessel. And all the specialness is in this kind of otherworldly, mystical, insertion where you put the soul in, you pop it in. And now we have something really important and interesting that ruach or spirit or whatever is what matters. And that's where the magic is. And the material is inconsequential. I think what I hear in this text instead is a very subtle recognition that there are things about what is very striking or distinctive about life that really arise from the material itself. And we shouldn't be rushing headlong into attributing everything that's sort of interesting or special about what living things are doing to something that exists in a non-material way. So how do we start building that up a little bit? So first of all, there's a source, a very peculiar source in Sefer Shmuel, which is about when David HaMelech conquers Jerusalem from the Yebusim. He conquers Jerusalem from the Jebusites. And they have this sort of weird shouting match where they say, oh, well, you know, you're not going to take the city because anyone, you know, who attacks us, even the lame and blind, will fight them. And so then David successfully conquers, you know, David, the city of David. And at the end it says, Al ken yomeru iveru fiseach lo yavo el abayit. So, that's why they say the blind and the lame. And then the grammar is kind of weird. Lo yavo el abayit it's not lo yavu, it's lo yavo. So he or it won't come to the house. So this source on its own, I think, doesn't prove anything, but I think there's a Gemara we're about to look at that I think resonates very strongly with this. So I'll make the point at the outset. This, to me, what I hear in it is a very Judaic and a very ancient Judaic insistence that we don't want to talk separately about the body and the soul. We think of them as being very intertwined and interrelated. And we should be reluctant to talk in sort of purely mystical or spiritual terms as though there's kind of a world where it's not material. It has no measurable sort of properties. And we can't assay it and tell whether claims being made about it are correct or not, but we can have all sorts of stories that we tell about how those sort of spirits interact with each other. That instead, this is really embodied. The reason we're talking about Yerushalayim here is Yerushalayim is the place where we're going to build Beit HaMikdash, right? Beit HaMikdash is the ultimate insistence, you know, along with the Mishkan, that relationship to HaKadosh Baruch Hu is possible in a physical world, and it has to do with what you build in that physical world and how you assemble its parts in a way that produces a certain relationship. So the Mishkan, the tabernacle in the temple, is not a Mishkan unless you take all of these materials and all of these things that could be assembled into lots of different structures and you put it together in a particular way. And that structure becomes the basis of relationship, because of the context of how all these pieces are put together and what meaning that produces. And I think that the essence of that idea is that you're not going to separate the soul from the body. You're going to have a body that is alive and active, and that the soul is the way that you talk about the complexity of context and meaning that animates the actions of the body. So why does this text have to do with that? What does it have to do with the blind and the lame? So there's this wonderful source in Masechet Sanhedrin, which I'm not sure whether it's being quoted here in that context. Yeah, I think it is. So there's a... It may also appear elsewhere, There's a Mishnah that says that anyone who says that Tchiyat Metim, the resurrection of the dead, doesn't appear in Chumash, in the five books of Moses, is a heretic, which of course is kind of a tough one because it is hard to find a verse that seems to pertain to that. But then there's this subsequent discussion between Yudan Nasi and Antoninus, who is this kind of philosopher Roman emperor character that appears in the Talmud, where they're talking about different things to do with, you know, the resurrection of the dead and the meaning of life and the boundary between life and non-life. And one of the things that they talk about is the soul and the body. And so Yehudah HaNasih makes a parable. Antoninus makes a parable to Yehudah HaNasih talking about the body and soul, where he talks about the idea of a king who asks two people to guard his garden. He asks a blind man and a lame person to guard his garden. And he does that because, or his orchard, actually. He does that because he thinks that each of them will be incapable of robbing him. And so they'll just be good guards, but they won't be able to steal the fruit themselves. But then, of course, these two gentlemen get to conspiring, and they realize that if the lame man rides on the shoulders of the blind man, then they actually can steal from the garden. So they do so. And then afterwards, they claim that they couldn't possibly have been the criminals, right? They can't be the culprit because the lame person says, do I have any legs with which I would be able to walk and take the figs? And the blind man says, do I have any eyes with which I would be able to see the weight of the figs? And so what does HaKadosh Baruch Hu do, or what does the king do here in this case? He puts the blind man on top of the shoulders of the lame man and he judges them together, right? And that's supposed to be how we understand the way that HaKadosh Baruch Hu judges us, that he doesn't judge our souls and he doesn't judge our bodies. He judges us, soul and body together. And that is the whole that is worthy of judgment, because each of these concepts, if we try to construct the idea of a body without a soul, if we try to construct the idea of a soul without a body, we're going to kind of fall short of capturing what the whole is capable of and why it matters. And I think that that's a theme that you actually see running all over in especially the most ancient sources that we have in Chumash, in Tanakh, in the Gemara. I know there's a whole lot of stuff, especially in the Gemara, and some of it, I think, sounds sometimes very much like it's about ghosts and spirits. I find every source that I have ever heard of that tries to treat these subjects, if you look carefully, it's actually very, very precisely constructed. So it is not giving you an easy way of just talking about the soul like it's magic in a bottle. It is a much more complicated thing to try to discuss what might be meant by a soul that is not connected with a body that possesses that soul. So the question is the soul a separate thing? And is it in that case a material thing or an immaterial thing? And in that case, if it's an immaterial thing, what is such a thing as an immaterial thing and why does it matter? And how could it matter? You know, you can pose that series of questions. Or do we have the idea or the notion or the words for that a soul, because we're going to talk about what living things do in their material capacities in ways that require an evocation of what that whole is capable of and what it might mean. And one thing I just like to point out along these lines is that if you think about all the different words we use for kind of spiritual stuff in Hebrew that come from the tradition, they all are extremely material and rooted in the idea of a physical substrate. And you always maybe could be talking about something that we also think of as being more purely material. Ruach is both spirit and also wind. Neshama is both maybe a word for soul, but also breath, right? Nefesh is another word for soul. But we're told in source 10 that the nefesh is blood. That what we're talking about with nefesh is it's the idea of the holistic connection of the body that the blood represents. So nefesh is like blood. Neshama is like breath, you know, literally like that. And you can just keep going like this. Anything you think of, you know, Hevel, I'm wondering if I'm missing another one, if someone can think of it. But each example like this, it's both steam or something maybe that's like a little more kind of abstract and can sound spiritual. And I'd even say that it's interesting that Chazal, in their notion of the intellect, they don't talk about the head or the brain. They talk about the heart. Why is that important? And really, that's the lesson of the Torah itself. The Torah talks about people saying things in their heart. The heart is actually audible, right? You can just listen to someone's heart and you learn things about how they're feeling, because if they're excited, their heart beats faster or something like that. So it's this whole idea of you don't develop a language for talking about the internal life of the human being that doesn't have a kind of a physical or measurable or observable testimony in the world. And I think the reluctance to separate these two concepts and allow them to exist as things to be talked about, one without the other, is a very strong theme that I would draw all the way through Chumash and Tanakh, and into the teachings of our sages in the Talmud as well. So what is the bottom line of that? I think the bottom line of that is that that's in one sense going to make it a little, it will seem at first like it makes it difficult for us to give Moshe in the end the argument, the counter argument against Paro that we're trying to give him. Because it at first seems like the easy thing would be to say, well, Paro, you think that human beings are just sort of particles of dust or quintessences of dust, right? They're just bricks, they're just collections of material that doesn't matter, so they don't matter, and you can use them like they're bricks, and you can sort of build your empire on the top of their corpses if you want, and it doesn't matter and it doesn't mean anything, so do as you wish. But you're wrong, and the reason you're wrong is that actually these bodies have immortal souls, and souls are what makes them so special, that they contain this separate spiritual immaterial substance that automatically imbues each of them with meaning. And at first it sounds like, okay, well, you know, we've solved the problem, because that is a claim about the world that would give life, human life especially, separate status from let's say, you know, bricks or whatever else. Except that it's very exposed to attack. And I think it's ultimately a very Christian or perhaps also Islamic idea. And to the degree that you hear thinking like this in Yahadut, I would argue it's sort of seeped in over the last 1500 years or so from constant exposure to ideological systems that are more to the hilt, on board with this way of thinking. But I think a counter argument from Paro, which is also, I think, maybe one that Chazal, would agree with, is, what is this thing that you're talking about that automatically confers meaning on a body which is just a collection of particles of dust, so to speak? What does it do in the world to give that meaning? Like, if it isn't something that we actually can sort of measure or observe and interact with, then how does it have the power to confer meaning? What is its role in the thing that it's a part of? Because all we ultimately usually mean when we say the soul has left the body or vice versa is it's like whether you're alive or not, right? So we're really just talking in a sense about being a living thing or being the remnants of a living thing. But if a living thing is alive, you know, lots of non-living things move and have stuff flowing into them and out of them like a river. So we haven't really solved the problem of what the soul does to give that special status. And it becomes very kind of curious and questionable how we're supposed to make that argument stick. So I obviously left a big question to the last few minutes. And so we're not going to resolve this all today. I think it's much better to try to say one brief point and leave it at that rather than pretend to address this question in 20 minutes without actually having fully done so, because it's a very big question. But I do think that the signs that are being given to Moshe really do mean to try to point us in the right direction for this discussion. Now, why do I say that? I think that the linchpin actually is the tzara'at. That when we go back to tzara'at, we encounter in tzara'at, in this anomaly in the skin of a person, which Moshe has in these signs that are being given to him. It's the ultimate, let's say, legal fiction as reality. When I say fiction, I don't mean that really that it's fiction and therefore it's not real. What I mean more so is that it's a legal construction that becomes reality because of the way we treat it. Meaning that it is, on the one hand, about the physical characterization of the body and even its boundary. And on the other hand, it isn't a dermatological phenomenon. It's not, by definition, an objective phenomenon. It is only a phenomenon that can be characterized by the Kohen, as we see here by the priest here in source 11. And also, it's not a material property. And maybe the best evidence of this is that in tzara'at, if a person has tzara'at that erupts on their skin and is of a certain color, but it spreads to cover the whole body, they don't have tzara'at anymore, by definition. A mitzorah, it's somehow about ambiguity or contest in the color of the skin. But if it spreads to cover the whole body, then by definition, they no longer have tzara'at. And so it's not actually, in a sense, about like some substance spreading through their skin. It's about a rule that we create that defines how a Kohen, how a priest may perceive and judge tzara'at or not. And I think what this gets back to is it's very much more like, let's say, divorce or murder than it is like a doctor, you know, measuring whether someone has a certain mutation in their genome or a physicist weighing them on a scale. It's a procedural definition that creates a framework of meaning, and then that framework of meaning is something that people can participate in, and it ends up affecting their behavior. So the same way that divorce, the same way that murder pertains to, in one sense, things that happen in the world, that happen in the physical world, and even that pertain to biology, right? Because murder is about someone who died. But in another sense, they have a definition that lives in a legal framework and is ultimately about obligations for people to behave certain ways, and ultimately is about the judgments of people about right and wrong, or whether someone should be separated from the group and things like that. Tzara'at has that same kind of property, and what it's pointing us to, I think, is that ultimately, if we're looking for meaning in the separate status of the living thing, this isn't meaning that we should be looking for in it like it's a physical property or like it's some other sort of measurable property, like you could stick a thermometer in that detects a soul. And then if it has a soul, then it means something and it matters. Instead, the idea, which I think the Torah is presenting to us and is giving to Moshe as this counterargument to Paro, is that the frameworks of meaning that we commit to as a brit, right? That these are the things that confer separate meaning and status to life. So it isn't the case that we are going to ask a physicist whether they can prove ultimately whether life matters or not by making some kind of judgment about its material properties. And it's fine to admit that life is, in one sense, built out of material things. But there still is the question of whether in our activities, whether we're building a mishkan, and whether we're building a tabernacle in the temple, or whether we are engaging in a procedure that identifies colorations on people's skin as having status with respect to tuma and tara, impurity, or not, that those activities and laws and judgments that we commit to, they create a framework of meaning that ultimately can make human life something different than the material out of which it is built. So I fully acknowledge that, you know, that is a very brief attempt at grappling with something that we should consider, you know, one of the hardest problems to take on. But that's what comes at me out of the text that we've been considering. And I think it ultimately, I think the answer has to be something like this because of how strongly I hear the Hebrew prophets and our sages inveighing against the idea of a spirituality which has a magical and separate immaterial status that is unconnected from the physical substrate to which it is meant to be connected and with which it is meant to be judged. So I know I just ran over a bit, but I'm happy to stay around and look through the chat at questions. Also, you know, if people want to make any audio comments, I'm going to start reading through the chat now, but if people also want to jump in and comment, I'm fine with that too. So let's see. Isn't the difference between inanimate and alive gods blowing the breath into the inanimate? What does the Talmud and Tanakh say about the breath? So the short answer to the last part of the question is, I think it's a subject that gets referred to a huge number of times in different contexts. And so it's hard to sort of summarize all of that. But I think the relevant thing with the idea of Vayipach Be'apav, that Hashem blew the breath of life into man's nostrils, that there's something about encounter and relationship that is being evoked there, meaning that to the degree that the motion of air in and out of the nostrils of a living human being is something we should call the breath of life, as opposed to just some other motions of air that could be happening, it actually has to do with the relationship that becomes possible with HaKadosh Baruch Hu as a result of the specialness of how the air, so to speak, is moving in that particular place. So human beings have a different potential than other parts of creation because they're made b'tzelem Elohim, they're made in the image of God, and that means that we have the potential for a relationship to Hashem in a way that other pieces of matter don't, right? And so I think that in that verse, I would just focus on the possibility of encounter with Hashem as being the significant point in what makes the breath of life there something other than moving air of no greater consequence. River deltas and tributaries are an inanimate analog to the human system of veins and arteries, is a comment. Yeah, so, and I think you can't strain that too much because obviously veins and arteries don't emerge in living things because of the flow of liquid through sediment or something like that. So it's much more just visually evocative than anything else. But I do think at another level, the notion of energy and matter flowing as being something that drives that complexity and also being able to perceive about one's own body that that's true, there's another level of parallelism there. And actually, we seem to have gotten through the comments. So
thank you.
I've enjoyed this very much, and I've appreciated so much all the comments and feedback. It's been really fun to get to do this.
Thank you very much. Yasher Koach. Okay, all the best. We appreciate it, and really something a little different than our typical sort of, you know, more standard type of shirim. It's really a pleasure to hear you share your talents with us. So thank you very much on behalf of everybody. Okay. All right, everybody, next class tomorrow night, Dr. Sokolow, 8 o'clock, How Tanakh Was Put Together, Parsha Shir, 8:30 p.m. Thursday night, Rav Aviyat Tabori, and then Friday morning, 9 a.m., my Shir on the Siddur. Okay, we'll look forward to learning with you, and invite a friend, and everybody be well, and be safe, be well, be healthy, and all good things. Okay, have a good day, everybody. Laila Tov.